Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What if we had a show about solutions?
You know, a repair manual for the real world.
Not the same old left versus right.
I am right,
I'm right.
And you are wrong.
Boring.
Yeah, something new.
Yeah, something new. How to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
So Richard, today's show I'm really excited about because it's a guy I've known for a long time, law professor Glenn Reynolds, who I think is one of the most interesting thinkers about law and government out there today. Very much a contrarian, looking at the world from a non-traditional perspective. So, and he's going to be talking about this never-ending problem of this revolving door between government and business.
Yeah, this has been going on for a very long time, and recently there have been more glaring examples. For instance, the Obamacare architect Liz Fowler, who left government for a big-paying pharmaceutical job, and then there's the Republican FCC commission member Meredith Atwell Baker, who took a lucrative position at Comcast.
Yeah, and just a week or two ago, you know, the Obama Justice Department Attorney General Eric Holder, instead of going, he could have been a judge or he could have been, you know, done a lot of different things. He went back to his super high powered Wall Street law firm. Apparently, they never even cleaned out his office. You know, they knew he was coming back. Now, we don't know how much money he's making, but you can be damn sure it's a lot more than he was making.
Yeah, and the really disturbing thing about Holder, for instance, is that the biggest criticism of his time as attorney general when it comes to handling Wall Street was, why wasn't any top banker ever prosecuted or sent to jail?
Well, you know, Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone had an interesting piece on this. He said, it's one of the biggest quid pro quo deals in the history of government service, you know, and I don't know if it's explicitly that, but implicitly, this happens all the time. People protect their friends. They know they're going to be going back to this industry. They don't want to make too many waves.
And so this revolving door thing really raises a lot of disturbing questions.
Yeah, and for
questions.
Both sides, both liberals and conservatives are concerned about this. So our guest today is law professor Glenn Reynolds from the University of Tennessee. Glenn writes a column for USA Today. He's written a number of books on law and policy.
And he's also really well known, isn't he, for InstaPundit.
Probably his big old claim to fame is, yeah, he's one of the original really big bloggers who really helped create the blog revolution with his blog InstaPundit that brings kind of a conservative libertarian view to a lot of issues of the day, but also obsesses about technology and culture and a lot of other topics.
Okay, so let's get on with it. Glenn Reynolds. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And it's How Do We Fix It? So you've come up, Glenn, with this proposal for a revolving door surtax. What is that? What are you trying to do with that?
I was looking for ways to deal with this. And, you know, I wrote a book on political ethics back now over 15 years ago called The Appearance of Impropriety. There are all kinds of laws and designed to limit influence peddling, and they've all been basically complete failures. So I was trying to think what would work. And I said, well, what part of the federal government are people actually afraid of? What part has teeth? And that led me to the IRS. And I started thinking, it was actually occasioned by Elizabeth Warren complaining about what she called the Wall Street shuffle of people going from regulators to, you know, places like Goldman Sachs and back and forth. And I said, well, you know, when you hire somebody who's worked in the government to work for your big corporation or lobby group or whatever, you're hiring them not just for sort of who they are, but for what they know and who they know. And those are all connections they've made while they work for the government. So it seems only fair for the government to share in those profits somehow.
On the surtax, just walk me through a little bit more how you think it should work. What rate, ideally, should the surtax be?
So my proposal is a surtax, which is it's a tax that goes on top of whatever your regular income tax is. And you know, we could haggle about the rates. I proposed 50%. I could be convinced to go higher. The way it would work is you leave the government. Say you've been a fairly senior government executive. You made a good government salary, say $100,000 a year. You go to a place outside the government where you're making $500,000 a year. 50% of the difference between your government salary and your private sector salary just is taken right off the top as a surtax. So you would pay $200,000 in that, and then you'd pay regular income tax on the remaining $300,000, just like everyone else. It's only fair for the government to sort of claw some of that back.
And what should be the trigger for this? For instance, if you went to out of the government to a job that didn't make you a huge amount of money, should you be affected?
No. Well, if say you made $100,000 in the government and you went to another job that paid you $100,000, the surtax wouldn't apply because it only applies to the difference between the two salaries. And if there's no difference, there's no surtax.
How big is this problem of the revolving door?
Well, it's pretty big. We hear about it mostly in the context of political appointees, but there are huge numbers of people in the senior civil service who do the same thing. And, you know, I don't want to throw stones. Again, you leave a government agency, you more than double your salary, and you're hired by somebody to basically address the regulations that you were enacting when you worked for the agency. And that's problematic in two ways. The easy way that it's problematic is that when you get out, you're basically rewarded for creating complicated regulations, because the more complicated the regulations you create while you're in the government are, the more people need to hire you to understand them when you get out. But the even more problematic part of this is that when you are in the government and thinking about retiring and moving to a more lucrative position outside, you also kind of have the incentive not to foul your nest, not to make people outside the government dislike you enough that they won't want to hire you when you get out. So there's a real incentive to be friendly to the industries that you're regulating and not to push them too hard. You may do a lot of stuff for show, to play in the news or to please your superiors, but when push comes to shove, you're probably going to pull your punches on the stuff that really matters to these constituency groups.
Right, right. So I think, you know, one place that a lot of people were aware of this phenomenon happening was in the military-industrial complex, where these big generals are on the team that are speccing out the new jet. They don't have much incentive to hold down costs because they know when they retire, Lockheed or whoever the contractor is going to be a great place to go work, and they want to be as friendly as possible. What you're saying is that the kind of low-level legal corruption has become the model for all sorts of industries.
Well, yeah, I mean, peace activists came up with this term back in, I think it was the 60s or the 70s, about defense, called the Iron Triangle. And the idea was, you know, you had this triangle with three legs. One is the people in the Defense Department. One is the group of contractors and companies that benefit. And then the third leg is the congressional delegations that are influenced by both of them. And the thing about this is, it's just as true everywhere else in the government.
Yeah, yeah. So this problem has grown. It's much bigger.
Yeah, and it was never limited only to the defense world. That was just the part they chose to emphasize. But it's always been this way. Since at least the big administrative explosion. Beyond all these, you know, sort of financial issues, there's another side of it. There's a strong tendency for chumminess, simply because, you know, if you're a guy and you work at, I don't know, say you work at the FAA and you regulate drones, who cares about drones? Most people care a little, but, you know, Google cares about drones a lot. Amazon cares about drones a lot. You go to conferences where people talk about drones. You meet people from the drone industry because they care and they're there. Even if there weren't all this stuff, people would tend to be kind of chummy, just because you're typically working on stuff that's kind of arcane, and the only people who care about it as much as you do are the people you're regulating.
You know, but isn't it helpful to have people in the government who know about the industries that they're regulating, and vice versa, having executives in these industries who know how to deal with government?
Oh, absolutely. It certainly is. But at some point, it gets to the point where it gets hard to tell the industry from the government. And I think we're well past that point in an awful lot of areas.
I think one thing that we see happen a lot is that it's not all members of the industry. It's the top players. It's the big boys, the big banks. as you said, more complicated regulations don't usually hurt the biggest players, but they tend to keep out the upstarts and the newcomers.
No, that's right. Regulation tends to favor big entities that can afford to have an office devoted to compliance, as we like to call it in the field, over small ones that don't. And that's even before you get to the point that the rules you adopt tend to be adopted with the influence of the big players and are set up to be barriers to entry, often quite consciously, by those big players. So all of that together means that the more regulation you have, the more of a drag you have on innovation and the more protection you have for established players against competition. And the revolving door only makes that worse because, as you say, very few people leave the federal government to go to a 12-person startup.
You've been talking about this this idea of the revolving door surtax for a while. What kind of reception have you gotten?
So one of the interesting things about this idea is that, you know, I see it as sort of libertarian, I guess, and some people might see it as sort of right-leaning because it limits the power of the bureaucracy. But overall, I'd say it's been more positively received on the left. When I wrote the column, I heard pretty quickly from Elizabeth Warren's office, and they liked it. I got an editorial endorsement in the Boston Globe. And then Bill Moyers, who's sort of, you know, the eminence Greece of the left, I guess, wrote a piece endorsing it in the Huffington Post. So I think that it's something that actually has both left and right support. The only real people who don't like it, I guess, are the people it would influence. But of course, they have a lot of influence.
Yeah, so maybe it's a non-starter. But wouldn't a conservative argument against it be that, wow, do we really need one more complication in an already too complicated tax code?
I would be happy to simplify the tax code dramatically. But that said, I don't think this complicates the tax code very much compared to lots of other stuff that we do on a regular basis. It applies to a relatively small number of federal employees, and the actual application of it is pretty simple. You take what somebody made when they work for the government, and you apply a surtax to the difference between that and what they make when they get out. And I actually do suggest a few complications, if you will, such that, for example, somebody who left a high-paying job in private industry to go to the government and then goes back out shouldn't be punished for that. And maybe the baseline there should be what they were making when they entered the government rather than what they made when they were at the government. But that's the sort of thing that congressional committees that write tax laws are supposed to deal with, and I think it's well within their abilities.
What about the Singapore example, Glenn, where in Singapore, the government pays its top executives a very large amount of money so that they're not corruptible? Is that one alternative to get to pay, for instance, Eric Holder, the Justice Department, far more than he was paid in the administration?
You know, it's not a bad idea, but you have to couple it with some other kinds of limits because, you know, I'm always reminded of that scene from the Star Wars movie where Princess Leia offers Han Solo more money than he could possibly imagine. And his response is, I don't know, I can imagine an awful lot. even if we paid, if we doubled or tripled the pay of federal civil service people, that's still peanuts compared to what you can earn if you leave and work for Google or Goldman Sachs. So I don't think that works unless you couple it with just a ban on post-government employment that, you know, you work for the government till you retire and then you're retired and you get a very generous pension, but you're not allowed to work for anyone else. That, I think, would be, frankly, something I wouldn't necessarily oppose, but it would be a considerably more drastic step.
So, Glenn, really fascinating idea. And, you know, as always, you're taking an issue that a lot of people have worried about and finding a way to really to focus in on it. And it opens up a great discussion about the impact of the, you know, our relationships between government and business, even if the revolving door surtax never really does come to fruition. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So, Jim, I think what Glenn Reynolds has to say about the revolving door and the surtax is a really interesting proposal. I'm not sure it'll ever get through Congress because it directly affects so many people who would have to decide about it. But it's, on balance, a really good idea. Glenn Reynolds is not somebody who I usually agree with. He's a conservative. He's a libertarian. He's more towards your view of the world. But still, this is a really interesting proposal.
Well, and it wasn't it intriguing that he said that, you know, a lot of people on the left have embraced it, and for good reason. I mean, people on the left should be very concerned about this kind of legal corruption where big government protects big business. I mean, that's not the way liberals want the world to operate.
One of the things that we didn't discuss is the impact on corporate welfare. I mean, there are so many areas of government where large corporations get a tax break or they get a regulatory break or something like that. If there wasn't quite such a close relationship between top government officials and top industry officials, maybe that wouldn't happen quite so much.
Right, right. Well, here's what I like most about this idea. I think so often something goes on in government and business people don't like. They want to ascribe it to some moral failing. The lobbyists are evil. The corporations are greedy. You know, if you elected our side, this wouldn't happen. We wouldn't have all these lobbyists and stuff. But in fact, you know, the revolving door and the lobbyists, all of it is a response to really strong incentives. I mean, if the government can make or break your business, you'd be crazy not to try to influence regulations, but either for or against. It's not necessarily evil. But we create so many incentives that encourage that behavior. And then we get all high and mighty that people respond to the incentives. What I like about the revolving door surtax is it takes away one of the incentives for this. And instead of just saying, don't do this because it's evil, just say, we're going to take the money away. We're going to make it less profitable for you to go into government, do a bunch of favors for big business, then get out and double your pay because, you know, you've got all these government connections now.
I wonder, you know, something I wish I'd asked Glenn about is whether there are great examples of this on the state level, because the federal government clearly is the biggest problem here. But I wonder if some states have tried to be aggressive.
Well, certainly all states have the similar issues. And you do see, you know, really unproductive regulation on the state level, too. I mean, right down to it's almost incredibly expensive, difficult to get a license to, you know, braid hair in New York State because the hair salons have gotten all these rules to try to make sure you get all kinds of training. They just want to keep out the competition and the officials support them. So trying to break up this overly chummy relationship between business and government is good. And I also like the idea because for people who think that regulation solves every problem, it shows you that sometimes regulation's part of the problem. You want to regulate the banks, great, but guess what happens? Goldman Sachs gets more powerful, not less, in the end.
Well, and also, it's the nature of the regulation. You can be in favor of regulation of certain industries, but it's the nature of it. It's written.
And believe me, like, I'm writing a book about disasters right now. I am not saying we don't need regulation, but we have to be honest with ourselves. Just because we say the regulation is going to rein in the greedy business people, it doesn't usually work that way.
And
you have to be really focused in what you regulate.
And just in case you don't think this really matters, let's take a really local example. Here in New York City, we've got the mayor threatening to crack down on Uber.
Oh, this is a great example.
Which is a really popular right. ride-sharing service. And some of that may well be because he's got buddies in the taxi industry that hate Uber.
Oh, they've given tons of money to his campaign, you know, people on city council. And here's what's really interesting. You know, de Blasio is one of the most left-wing major politicians in America today. You'd think he'd be on the favor of the poor, minorities, people who don't get a lot of attention, you know, in our political system. Well, our taxi system in New York is heavily biased in favor of rich people who live in Manhattan. That's where the taxis are, and they can afford the expensive limousines. Uber is really good for serving people in the outer boroughs. And, you know, minorities are sometimes have a little bit of trouble getting picked up by a cab. Uber's going to come to your door and pick you up.
So that's just one example.
And so de Blasio, I'm going on a rant about this because it just drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Big entrenched businesses have a lot of control over government, even over ostensibly left-wing politicians like de Blasio.
Jim, on this, I hate to admit it, but I agree with you.
We actually
100%.
Agree. And that's our show for the week. I'm Jim Meggs.
And I'm Richard Davies.
How Do We Fix It is produced by Miranda Schaefer. Our audio engineer is Denise Barbarita here at the beautiful Mono Lisa Studios in Upper Manhattan. And our music theme is by Lou Stravinsky.
How Do We Fix It is a production of Davies Content. We do digital audio for creative companies. Reach us at daviescontent@gmail.com.
Great.
That was fun. That was good.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.